Welcome to Update One, the podcast of the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Update One provides a forum for listeners to learn about national stories focusing on news, politics, and current events. Now, the latest edition of Update One.
Thank you, Mike Kempen. I'm Mark Hamrick, Senior Economic Analyst with Bankrate.com, a former president of the National Press Club, which brings you this podcast from the nation's capital. And I am so pleased today to be speaking with Michelle Singletary. She is the nationally syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, responsible for the award-winning column, The Color of Money. Michelle, thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And thank you for your column, by the way. It really is one of the best personal finance-themed columns around. Now, you've been writing this for how many years now?
Oh, you're going to make me tell the year. Since 1997.
Now, congratulations.
Thank you.
A fantastic run, and we hope there are many more years ahead. Tell me how you got involved with writing it.
You know, I came to the Post in 1991. I'd been at the Baltimore Evening Sun for about 8 years and was recruited for the business section specifically to cover bankruptcy. Because while at the Sun, I developed an expertise because I just love bankruptcy. It was just a crazy thing, and there were so many business bankruptcies at that time. And so then I came over to the Post, and, you know, doing bankruptcy, doing small business coverage, you know, the normal reporter things. And my personality in the newsroom was a little different because I'm from Baltimore, raised by my grandmother, very frugal. And so while many of my colleagues are going out to do lunch, you know, in Washington, you do lunch. And I was be sitting there going, you guys are crazy. That's like $10, $12. Like, I can't do that. So I'm bringing my bag lunch and telling all these stories about my frugal grandmother. And my editor, David Ignatius, who everyone has to know who David Ignatius is, right? He said, you know, you ought to write something about all the stuff that your grandmother taught you about money. And so he challenged me to write this column. He said, I think you're going to find your voice. And, you know, I'm from Baltimore. I'm sort of a, you know, very homespun kind of girl. And when he said that, I thought, well, what do you mean voice? I don't hear voices in my head, you know. And so I sat down, and I tell you, it was so organic. I just started writing about all the money lessons that I learned from my grandmother and how I've taken them from, you know, growing up with her low income to going to college on a full scholarship, but having to send money home because even though I had a scholarship, we just didn't have any money. And then, you know, working for the Evening Sun and then the Washington Post of all places. And here I am, you know, in this newsroom with these brilliant people. And I just came from such a humble background. And I thought there's got to be people who can identify with this, you know, climbing up the ladder and still holding and clutching to the things that you learn from your grandmother or grandparents or parents. And so I wrote this column and I'll never forget the headline. It was Big Mama's Savings Grace. And this is way before email was really big. And we got bags and bags of mail. They had never seen anything like that for a business column. Mm-hmm. And people were like, oh, I could identify. And, you know, at that time, there was a picture of me, but it wasn't about the fact that I was African-American or that my grandmother was named Big Mama. It was just people felt for finally somebody was writing a business column or article that spoke to the average person. And so I heard from people who were white and black and Jewish and Christian and young and old. It's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. I grew up like that, or I wish I had a big mama like that. And, you know, I remember David came out of his office and he just set the column down after, you know, all these letters and calls and things. And he's just like, you did it, kid. That's what he said. And it just took off from there.
Doesn't get any better than that. And tell me about the title.
It was all about my grandmother, and I always called her Big Mama. And the funny thing is, she wasn't a big woman. She just carried herself so big. Mm-hmm. It was sort of an evolution of how I learned how to handle money from her. Mm-hmm. My grandmother took us in. There was five of us. My oldest sister was 8. I was 4. I had a sister who was 3, and twin brothers who were just under 2. And my grandfather was in the home, but, you know, bless his heart, he had a drinking problem. So all of his money never got home. And even through all of this, and my grandmother was a nursing aide, so she didn't make very much money. And despite all of that, she was able to raise the five of us. And she would not take the cash welfare. She was like, I don't want their money. I don't want them telling me what to do with you guys, but I'll take the health care. So we were on Medicaid because we were all very sickly. My brother had severe epilepsy. I had rheumatoid arthritis. There was a point in my childhood where I couldn't walk. I had a sister who had severe asthma and emphysema. So we were all pretty sick. So she's like, well, I can't handle the health. So please just give me the health care. I'll take care of the rest. And because of that, to this day, I'm still like, how in the world did she do this? Husband who wasn't bringing all his money home, nurse's aide, wouldn't take any welfare money, and yet she paid every bill on time, all the time. And so that's where the headline came, you know, Big Mama Savings Grace, that she could save, and she saved me.
So inspiring, not only to hear your story, but from the standpoint that I think you and I both share is we're trying to do work that helps to empower people to live more successful financial lives. And the reality is it's not just a struggle for those who have low incomes. There are people who have high incomes and aren't getting it done.
That's right.
Is that what keeps you going every day, hoping those people can do a little better?
Yeah, and I think that's the uniqueness of the column and for, I like to say, the brilliance of the Post letting me do this. Because, you know, it used to be, some out there might remember, the business section was not the glamorous place to be. Now people like being in the business section and scramble to get in there. But that used to be where you went to retire. You were a good reporter, but you were ready to be gone. I mean, I hate to say this, but it was sort of like a dumping ground almost. And I was working for the Evening Sun, and an editor, Patricia Fanny, was trying to build this team of young reporters. And I remember her coming to me and saying, do you want to be in the business section? And my heart dropped. And I thought, oh, am I not doing a good job? Like, what? There's like a bunch of old people there. And old white. Can I say that?
Sure,
I don't want
of course.
To sound like
it's,
a
that's true.
Thing.
It's true.
But it was just white guys.
Yeah.
And I just was, I was crestfallen. Like, what are you saying? And she said, no. I want to build a team. I want to have young reporters and older reporters and everybody passionate about business and economic writing. And so it was because of that. And I think bringing that to the Post and opening that door so that people see that money, it really does transcend so much, right? From low income to upper income. And I have found that people at every economic level have financial issues. And one group thinks it's just the other. Those who are at upper income think, oh, those people low income, they're lazy, they're not saving enough, they're not working hard enough. And then people in low income think, oh, those people have all that money and they're still broke. And when I speak to folks in my church, because I'm very active in my church, I have financial ministry in my church, and I tell them, how do you go broke on $200 million, right? You spend $201 million. Even Bill Gates could go broke. And we see this in athletes. We see this in upper income areas. And especially now, right after the Great Recession, so many people thought that they were safe. They thought they were safe. There were so many middle income and upper income folks who thought, I did everything that they told me to do. I went to college. I got a degree. I got married. I put my head down. I saved my little bit of money. But they were just a job loss away from having health care. Right? They were just a job loss away from losing their home. They were just a job loss away from having that financial security, because now the higher income you make, the longer it takes for you to replace that job, about 18 months. So, I mean, I don't even save that well. I mean, I could probably go a year, my husband and I, but 18 months, 2 years without a salary, that'll go through everything that
sure.
you save.
Absolutely.
So I try to speak to every group, upper income, middle income, lower income, to say that we are really in this together.
We've covered a lot of ground. One of the things that I heard as you were describing what ends up being diversity in the newsroom, because we are doing this from the National Press Club, journalism still has a problem with a lack of diversity, doesn't it?
It does. It does. In newsrooms and sections across the board, it's better. It's certainly better from when I first started, but it's definitely a concern. It's so funny you should say that, because like the name of my column is called The Color of Money. Every once in a while I'll get someone's like, oh, that's kind of racist. Why is it called The Color of Money? And I said, well, we kind of was doing it tongue-in-cheek for a number of reasons. Color of money is green. We all need money. I'm African-American. So we were playing on a whole bunch of fields with that. But it does concern me. And when you look out the landscape, you know, I'm still one of the few African-American financial columnists out there in any blogs, you know, or major newspapers. There are more blogs, obviously, but at the level that I am right now, there's not very many, you know.
It's fair to say you're at the top. I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah, let's be honest. That's right. I mean, if you look at, you know, all the major papers and even the mid-level, yeah.
But you feel that journalism is doing better with diversity than it was? But there's still a long way to go.
There's still a long way to go, as it is with the country.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Right? I mean, we're step in step with the country. But, you know, the Post has made a lot of gains, and they do a good job. I mean, one of our personal finance columnists, Jonelle Marte, is just wonderful. You know, so we're doing better.
Yeah. But, you know, diversity has a lot of different flavors to it, right? So we learned in the presidential election that we didn't really understand beyond the Beltway very well, right?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether journalism can do a better job of trying to connect to those communities that reporters don't see every day on their drive to wherever.
I think that we missed the call of who our president was going to be because the folks that populate newsrooms didn't look like or come from the rest of America. It's so funny. I'm part of a book club, and about a year before President Trump even ran, or a year into him saying he was going to run, we were talking about it, and I said, he's going to win. And everybody in the book club was like, oh, you're crazy, you're crazy. I said, no. He's appealing to a group of people who feel isolated, because we in the press, we are the elite now, right? A lot of the newspapers, now not all of them, but the top level, they come from money or they are money. We make good money. We are middle, upper income. We've got, you know, 529 college savings plans, and we have a home, and we've got some equity in our homes. And we were very out of touch with the rest of America. And I said, he is appealing to that, and our arrogance is going to push them, because the more we told people that they were stupid for thinking that he could be president, the more I think it was a vote against us as opposed to for him. That they said, listen, we are out here, and our jobs are going away, and we don't have the security. We've worked just as hard as you have. Maybe we didn't go to college, or maybe we went and didn't finish, but we worked just as hard as you do. And I think we took too many people for granted. And if you're in a newsroom and you aren't in the community and you don't know what's going on, that's how we miss things. You know, I'm in my community. I'm a journalist, but I'm highly active in my church. And I have a financial ministry in my church. And so I see people, you know, everyday walks of life. It was so funny. Just before the Great Recession, I was having a discussion with another reporter in the newsroom, and he was talking about what would be the leading indicators of a recession. And, you know, it was the normal stuff that, you know, my God. And I said, nah, lipstick. If lipstick still goes down, he's like, what? I said, listen, women will spend their last $5 on lipstick. But if that goes down, and sure enough, some of the, you know, indicators where people weren't buying, you know, sort of things like that. And we know we were laughing about it, but it's like you got to have your finger on what the regular folk, that's what I sort of say, regular folk, that's sort of where this country lies.
Well, that's genius. So have you written anything on the lipstick indicator?
I have not.
Well, that's still to come. So we might have generated that here today. So I want to think about what we can leave the audience with that ultimately is connected to your expertise and experience. As we get ready to close, if people were to do one thing with their finances to help themselves just a little bit, maybe it's one group of society, maybe it's everybody, what would you like to see them do?
You know, if I can, I'd like to take it in sections. And I'll tell you why. The advice at the end is going to be the same. I volunteer at prisons in Maryland, actually two prisons, a men's prison and a women's prison. And I go in to teach financial literacy. I volunteer. It's like a 5 or 6 week program where I teach inmates who are about to be released how to handle their money. And someone asked me, how do you teach them differently? What do you tell them differently? And I said, I don't tell them anything differently. What do you mean? I talk to them about investing. I talk to them about live below your means. It's the exact same thing. Because every part of society is the exact same thing. It's a little different in the sense of if you're lower income, let's try to figure out a way to not just live paycheck to paycheck. And that might mean that you're going to be able to give, you're going to have to give up some of the things that we have qualified as the American dream. It may mean that not everybody and your family is going to have their own home. You might have to do shared housing and multi-generational housing because you all can't have an apartment. You all can't have a house. It's not sustainable. So that advice would be different for them. Still live below your means, but you got to live a little differently. If it's middle income, it's like, okay, you got a little bit of money, but, you know, you start to feel yourself, you know, I can do this. I can take multiplications and I can send my kids to private school at the expense of saving for college. And, you know, I got to have that car every 4 or 5 years because, you know, I got to show people that I'm successful. Right? And so you take on all this college debt, you have debt and your kid has debt, and now as it gets to retirement, you don't have enough. So you got to live below your means, but instead of maybe you can still have that house, but you can't have that car every 4 or 5, 6 years. No, your kid can't go to an Ivy League school or a name brand school. You don't have the money. So send them to a state school or let them go to community college for 2 years and then transfer. They're still going to get a great college education. And guess what? They're going to end up working at the same place that all those other people went. I work at the Washington Post, and sitting across from me was a guy who went to Harvard. I went to the University of Maryland in College Park and had to send money home. But we both ended up at the Post. So that's what I tell them. And upper income, listen, you guys got the room. You've got space in your budget. Don't live like you're Bill Gates, right? It's the same lesson. Live below your means. Whatever you make, spend less. Take that money and leverage it. Save for your kids' college education from the time they're born because you've got the money, right? You've got the money. And you know what? At some point, maybe take in a relative who hasn't done as well, because oftentimes in upper income families, there's one or two who's made it and then a whole bunch who haven't. And my husband have opened up our doors consistently to relatives who haven't. We let them come in, we let them not pay rent, save, so then they can launch. The message to them is still live below your means, but, you know, use your resources not just to help your family, but to help your extended family and the community. You know, I'm a big believer in giving first out of your budget. So you see the message is the same. And if you go back to the inmates, they definitely have to live below their means because they're coming out to a society who still wants to punish them, mm-hmm. right? And I tell people, you know, if nothing else, if you don't want to do it for the ex-offenders, do it for yourself because they will come out. The majority of them will be released. And if we don't give them education and show them how to handle their money and let them get jobs, they're going to go right back to doing what got them in the prison, which is not in our self-interest, right?
Absolutely.
And so let's help them. So this is why I go into the prison to help them. But I give them the exact same lecture. I fuss at them just like I do with people who make big money. You know, and their thing is they want a car. It's like, you can't have a car. You got to ride the bus. You know, and you got to live with grandma. If grandma's going to take you in, you're going to live with grandma for a while until you can save up. And so I guess the ultimate message is to everyone is that whatever you make, live on less. And as you do that, think about what is going to be your financial legacy. And for my husband and I, it's to send all three of our kids to college debt-free so that they can turn around and do the same for their children. But not only that, they can work in careers that may maybe not make as much as we've made. My two girls want to go into education. One wants to do special education and one wants to be a child psychologist working with children with like autism and things like that. Going to make decent money, but not great money. So we're teaching them how to live on that salary. I don't want to discourage them from doing that. And not everybody's going to make six-figure salaries, right?
Absolutely.
And so that's the message I sort of try to tell everyone. I just feel like sometimes the American dream has corroded our sense of entitlement, or it's played into our sense of entitlement. Everybody wants the same thing. Everybody can't have the same thing. And when I think about economic inequality, I don't think in a sense of everybody should have all the same amount of money. I just think that there ought to be a way that everybody can have a decent living, decent housing, educate their children so they can get decent jobs. And so one family, you might be able to take a vacation every 2 years. One family, you'll be able to take a vacation twice a year. But you still are going to have pretty good lives. And for me, that's what I hope for everybody.
I love that. My sense is that people listening to your words today can feel the passion that you have for your work that you brought to this table. So thank you for that. Thank you for joining us, and best wishes for the years ahead. I think you help to make the world a little better just with the work you do. So
I hope so. That's always been my goal.
Our guest has been Michelle Singletary, author of The Color of Money column for The Washington Post. I'm Mark Hamrick with Bankrate.com, former president of the National Press Club. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Update One, a production of the National Press Club's Broadcast Committee. You can comment on this show or any episode of Update One by going to facebook.com/PressClubDC or on Twitter @PressClubDC. Thanks for listening to Update One.